Well, first of all, thank you, Boris, for inviting me. And the trip was long and tedious. Yes, I was stuck in traffic a little bit, but I'm happy I'm here. And well, I'd like to say there's like Hollywood, then there's Venice, where they do the not so, you know, good pictures maybe. And then there's like Caltech, where we do like even worse ones. So let's see what you guys think after my talk. But I want to talk about single-cell dynamics of cellular differentiation. And I'm aware that it's a diverse crowd, and it's not a big crowd. So if there's anything that I say that's not like too horribly clear or something, feel free to interrupt me if you want. Well, when we commonly think of cellular differentiation, we think of sort of bistability. Jim Farrell and his lab has done a very good job at sort of establishing in how this really works in oocyte maturation, where you have a signal which is progesterone. It comes and turns on a positive feedback loop. In this case, it's a MAP kinase cascade. And that positive feedback loop locks you into the mature state. So you go from immature to mature oocyte. And this is sort of irreversible in the sense that the positive feedback loop keeps you from switching back. But I will show you later in the talk like an alternative mechanism for differentiation. Differentiation can also be a multiple choice event, such as shown here in the hematopoietic stem cell system, where you can go from one single cell, a stem cell, and you can make actually any of these. There's been like some really interesting studies where people have irradiated mice and completely sort of eliminated all of the hematopoietic system and supplemented these mice with very few cells, and they were surprised to see that a few cells were able to completely recapitulate the entire system. So it's a very complicated process that we don't really understand. And not only can it be multiple choice, but differentiation can also be probabilistic in the sense that there's a certain probability of making a B cell or a red blood cell, and this probability can change depending on certain environmental signals and so forth. And so one of the questions that you can ask if you think about probabilistic differentiation is what influences these probabilities? Is it the microenvironment? Meaning, is it signals that such as progesterone in the oocyte case that tell the cell to do one thing or the other one? Or is it the history, meaning maybe the decision was already, for example, to go to a B cell was already made here, perhaps in that lineage, right? Or is it cell autonomous, which would mean that these two factors are not important and the genetic circuit within the cell is actually the mechanism of making the decision. Now, to study these problems, I've focused on Bacillus subtilis. It's a great model system, and for the following reasons. First of all, it's well characterized. So there's been decades of research that has been done. We know lots of the important components. We know the interactions between them and so forth. It's quite easy to genetically manipulate them, meaning we can make transgenic lines. We can incorporate markers into the chromosome and so forth. And the most important part, of course, is that Bacillus can differentiate into multiple states. So here you see a little phase contrast picture of Bacillus subtilis in vegetative growth, where they divide and they're happy. However, when you stress them, they can adapt one of these multiple stress responses. The most famous one is sporulation, where they form spores that you can see here in phase bright. And these spores are very resilient to heat and all kinds of other factors. But today I'm going to focus on something that is a little different. It's competence. So competence is a well-defined state. And in this state, these cells can take up extracellular DNA and incorporate it into their chromosome. And here you see a microcolony under stress. And I'm showing you this because I want to point out the heterogeneity of the stress response, if you want. So you see all your normal cells. Here are your spores again. And in red, I'm using a late competence gene as a marker, which is expressing CFP. And here in false coloring, you see in red cells that are competent. And what's interesting here is that you have cells that are just starting to form spores. You have completely mature spores is here, is the case, where the mother cell has already lysed. Then you have cells that are still dividing. And so you can see it's a very heterogeneous sort of response. And under these conditions, it's also interesting to note that most of the cells go towards sporulation and only very few go towards competence. And it turns out actually that no matter what you do to the media, at least as much as we can do, you can't have more than about 20% of cells becoming competent. So there seems to be some sort of limit there. And I want to show you, first of all, that competence is a transiently differentiated state. And I'm going to show you a little movie of bacillus cells that are under stressful conditions, nutrient deprivation. And you will see how the colony expands and the stress response starts. And again, in red is a marker for competence. So you will see a red cell that appears. And let's take a look at this movie. Yep, it's running. Good. So the cells are dividing happily and they're starting to form spores. And here you see there was a cell that became competent. And then it exits competence. And as it's exiting competence, segmentation kicks in and you get all these daughter cells. And then they can continue and sporulate themselves or keep dividing a few times. Obviously, the conditions are getting worse and worse, so they're eventually going towards sporulation. And another interesting thing here is that it just pops out of sort of one region, and there's no like any correlations as to whether or not the competent cell was in the middle of the colony or at the edge. There's nothing like that that would indicate where you would get a competent cell. But you can see the important thing that I want to stress out here is that the cell becomes competent and it immediately sort of becomes competent, forms a little bit of a filament, right, and then it exits competence right away, right, as you can see there. And there it goes. Okay. So this means that this competence state, unlike the sporulation state, is not a stable state, meaning cells go in and then they naturally come out. Whereas sporulation, you can be stable at that state for years, actually. Now, so this raises several questions, one of which is, how is the cell fate decision being made, right? Another one is, how is the fraction of cells, how is that regulated? And another question is, what is the mechanism that takes the cells in and out of competence? And of course, we'd like to understand how the underlying genetic circuit supports all these phenotypic behaviors. Now, here's the overall problem. And it's very simple. So here you see the competence circuit, and this is from decades, literally, of research, and it depicts all the proteins and interactions that we know. And it's a very prototypical sort of genetic circuit map that you see for all kinds of different scenarios, systems. And here's the output, which is competence. So you want to, ideally, you'd like to infer from a genetic circuit what the output will be. However, this is a little bit difficult to go from the circuit architecture to the function. Why can't we do it? Well, there's several reasons. The first one is that, as I've shown you, differentiation is dynamic, right? But the wiring diagram that I just showed you in the previous slide is a sum of all of our knowledge. Not only is it a sum of all knowledge, but it's a static representation. There's no dynamics in there, but the process itself is dynamic. So if we really want to understand this, we need dynamics. Another problem is that this differentiation is a probabilistic and multiple choice event. So a population measurement, obviously, as you all know, will tell us a lot, but it's not going to really tell us everything because to really understand a probabilistic event, we need to study single cells. And luckily, we can do this by doing a quantitative time-lapse microscopy. We can basically use markers like I've shown you before. We'll use certain transcriptional fusions to fluorescence markers. We can incorporate them into the chromosome, which is better than having sort of plasmids where you can have some problems. And then we make movies out of these, and we can analyze the images. And we can then go back and try to do mathematical modeling of the circuit and try to go back and forth between these two and try to understand and make sense of what's happening. So we'd like to model the competent circuit, of course. I would not want to sort of write down all the possible equations that you see here. That would be crazy. So the question is, can we reduce the complexity? Obviously, we're going to lose some information by doing this, but perhaps we will gain a model that's maybe simple and oversimplified, obviously, and probably wrong. But will it be a good enough model as to where it can make some predictions that we can go and test? And The good thing is, as I mentioned, that this is a well-characterized system. So for example, we know that the most important player here is COMK, which is the master regulator for competence. It turns on over 100 genes, and it by itself is necessary and sufficient to initiate competence. And here's sort of my rendering, where I've already simplified a lot of the interactions. I sort of bundled them and so forth, and I'm focusing on mostly COMK and COMS. And let me just walk you through what happens to a cell as it encounters stress, if you want. So out here, you see that there's certain signals that feed into the cell, and that's because as the cells grow and divide and the population increases in size, you have a sort of a quorum sensing. So cells start to signal to each other that, you know, hey, we're all very crowded, it's getting stressful here, so you might want to consider, you know, initiating your stress responses. And these cell-to-cell communication factors, they eventually trigger down and activate COMS. COMS synthesizes a peptide, and this peptide can block the degradation of COMK by the MECA-CLIP-P-CLIP-C protease complex. Because during the normal cycle, what happens is you are constantly expressing COMK at a basal level from the COMK promoter. Okay, but COMK protein is not allowed to accumulate because you have this degradation machinery that constantly degrades it away. But what happens when you have COMS, it competes to the binding site, okay? And so you have this competitive degradation mechanism by MECA, and when you have a lot of COMS, now you're allowed to sort of build up COMK. When you build up COMK, it positively auto-regulates its own promoter, and here you have a nice prototypical positive feedback loop that sort of stabilizes the high COMK level, right? And then you have all these other regulators that regulate the COMK and COMS promoters. Now, one of the questions that I had is, where is the decision being made? One can think of various scenarios. One would be that it's all determined by cell-cell signaling, right? So that would mean that only in cells where you sort of turn on your COMS will you be able to become competent. And maybe COMS is only turned on in those cells that are destined to become competent. Well, a simple way to test this is the following. You just take the COMS promoter, you fuse a YFP to it, and you look at the expression. And as you can see here, all the cells are expressing COMS. So it's not that only cells that are sort of destined to become competent are the ones that are expressing COMS, but COMS is expressed in all the cells. What does that mean for our circuit? It means that we can eliminate this as sort of the source of the decision making, okay? Because whatever decision is being made has got to be downstream of COMS.
COMS expression.
COMS expression, yes.
Could be altering
COMS. The COMS expression could be altering
COMS function. Those extrinsic inputs are altering COMS function.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by altering. Right, but just for simplicity's sake, I think we're just going to ignore that. I mean, there's lots of sort of detailed things that scenarios one can come up with, and you're right. There's many scenarios, right? But the goal here is just to simplify it to something that I know it's not going to be correct, right? But is it going to be a useful model? That will be sort of the criteria by which we're going to measure success of the model. Now, there's actually much bigger problems also, right? Down here you have all these regulators that feed into COMK and COMS. So what are you going to do with those? Well, it turns out from the literature that all of these factors are important in the sense that they can affect the probability of competence, right? But none of them are necessary, meaning if you knock them out, you are still able to become competent. So just again, for simplicity's sake, we're ignoring these. And what we end up with is this very small core module, which we've called the MEX module, and you see our positive feedback loop, and you see our COMS. And the question is, of course, is there negative feedback? Why is there no negative feedback onto COMK? Why am I asking this question? Well, I've shown you in the movie that cells go from the vegetative state, they go into sort of competence, and then they come right out. So a simple way would be to have a negative feedback. Why? Well, you have a positive feedback here, so when you turn on COMK expression, you will be locked into COMK. How do you exit? How do you exit from this positive feedback loop, right? A simple way would be that we propose that if COMK protein would actually repress COMS production, right? And there's actually a little bit of sort of evidence in the literature where an indirect mechanism of this could actually be the case. And if this is the case, then it's actually easy, right? You have a positive feedback loop and you have a negative feedback loop right here that would sort of help you to exit from the competence state. And you can model this simple circuit and you can reduce it down to a very simple two-dimensional system. K and S are COMK and COMS, and alpha K is sort of the basal transcriptional rate that I've mentioned to you. Here is the production term with the rate and the positive feedback loop feeding into it, and here's the degradation of COMK, and over here is the production rate of S and the negative the repression from the K. And down here is again the degradation. You notice that the degradation terms are similar. They're actually symmetric. Why? Because as I mentioned to you, MEK has a competitive degradation mechanism, meaning it can degrade either COMS or COMK. So we assume that the two proteins are being degraded by the same mechanism, hence the similarity here. Now, because it's a two-dimensional model, we can do phase plane analysis, which is very informative actually. And here in green and blue are the null clients. Everybody knows what null clients are probably. But as you can see here, there's an intersection of the null clients and you have a fixed point. And in this case, the fixed point is a stable fixed point and it corresponds to the vegetative state. Why? Because look, COMK levels are low, right? And COMS levels are not that high either. So this would sort of correspond to your vegetative state. Now, as I mentioned to you, when cells become stressed, COMS expression is induced. So let's see what happens to our null client when you're increasing expression of COMS. Well, the null client goes up, and you get to this point where you now have an interesting regime where the two null clients intersect at three points, so you have three fixed points, but these two are unstable, and this is still the stable fixed point that would sort of correspond to the vegetative state. However, now towards higher COMK levels, you have the appearance of these two unstable fixed points. Now, this is a very familiar sort of dynamic regime. It's excitable, okay? And why is there a picture of a toilet here? Well, because the toilet is actually the everyday excitable system. This is actually an excitable system. Why? Well, here's the handle. So you jiggle the handle, right? And if you jiggle it enough, you will actually trigger the mechanism. The flush valve will open. You will fill it, your bowl, and then once the water level is enough, you will flush, and then it fills back up again. And this is just like that. Why? Because only in this resting state is the system stable. And once you trigger the handle and you release the system, it will not stop until it has performed sort of its cycle, its trajectory in the phase plane, if you want, right? And what determines the trajectory in our case? Well, it's the vector field. And here's what the vector field looks like for our competence circuit. As you can see, if you were to leave the vegetative state, you would be pushed around by the vector field and you would end up back at the fixed point right here. And you can see that the vector field sort of pushes you around here and goes back. Why? Because these two states are not stable states. And how do we jiggle the handle here? Well, we add a noise term. You can do an additive, you can do multiplicative, it doesn't really matter, it doesn't even matter where you put the noise term. Phenotypically, the behavior is the same. All you need is you need enough noise to sort of allow you to leave the fixed point so you can be dragged around by the vector field. And let me show you an actual simulation of the model. So here we are, we're jiggling the handle, if you will, and once we are able to leave the fixed point, as you see the cell, in this case the model, will go through an excursion in phase space. It goes towards an excursion that takes it from the vegetative state to sort of a competence regime. It's not really a state because, as I said, there's no stable fixed point there. So this is not a bistable system, it's an excitable system, right? And here's the full sort of potential of what this model can do. What I've shown you as the excitable system is obviously for a certain set of parameters, and if you have different parameters, you can be in a monostable vegetative state. If everything is very high, you will be sort of in a monostable competence state, and here's the excitable regime, and there's also a regime of bistability. Now, this is all very interesting and very nice because it explains naturally a lot of the observations that we have, but you know, we want to test this experimentally. We want to see how our model holds up. So one of the assumptions that I made at the beginning is that the COMK promoter is only regulated by the COMK protein. Meaning, remember, we ignored all of these other inputs. Now, how can we test this? Well, there is the COMG promoter, which is a late-stage competence gene that is exclusively regulated by the COMK protein. So there's no other inputs into COMG. Now, in the extreme case, if COMK promoter behaves just like the COMG promoter, it would mean that both are only affected by the COMK protein and these two promoters should be behaving the same. However, if these other inputs are important, then one can envision situations where the two promoters would behave differently. So to test this, what I've done is I've made a strain where I'm looking simultaneously at the two promoter activities by putting both of these COMG and COMK reporters with YFP and CFP respectively into the chromosome of Bacillus, and then we make a movie. And let's look at that. So here again you see cells growing, and right here is a cell that becomes competent, and it's in this sort of purplish color because red and blue combined gives you purple. And now let's look at the quantification of that. This is just a time series of the movie that I've just shown you. And here you see the time trace for COMK and COMG activity, and you can see that the two are really tracking each other very nicely. So the two are very highly correlated, and just to show you that this is sort of a general phenomenon, here are several more cells. And what this means is that the COMK promoter, that our assumption that these other inputs to it are not that important, at least in terms of the dynamics during competence, right? This doesn't mean that prior to competence or anything like that, right? We're just looking at the dynamical process. These inputs don't appear to be very important. Now, another prediction is that COMG and COMS should be negatively correlated. Why? Well, I already said that the... Oh, sorry, Boris. Yeah, most of them are inhibitory.
And so what kind of cells do you need? These are things that...
Well, I can... Right, I can give you sort of an explanation with no proof, if you want, right? So most of these things are designed possibly to keep the stress responses off when you don't want them, okay? So a lot of them are negative to keep you off, and then once you're sort of in the stressful environment, then you release the inhibitions and then the cells can adapt these different stress responses.
What is the exception to the rule? What is this right here?
This is part of a two-component system, okay? And what it can do is it helps the COMK protein bind to its promoter. So you can actually knock this out and everything is still fine, okay? But with no DEG U, the frequency of competence becomes less. Okay, now let's go back to the other prediction that I just pointed out, which is that COMG and COMS are negatively correlated. Why? Because right here, remember we made this assumption, this prediction that the COMK protein negatively regulates COMS promoter, it represses it, and here we have a promoter that is activated by it. So you would naturally expect, if our prediction is correct, that these two should be negatively correlated, the activities of these. Again, we make a movie where we look at the COMG and COMS promoter activities with YFP and CFP. I'm not even sure if you can see this from every all direction, but let me show you the movie. So in green is COMS, and in red is, as usual, the competence marker. So the cells are growing, they're expressing COMS, and one of them, the cell becomes competent. And if you notice, it wasn't a lot of yellow. It went from green to red, and then as it exits, green comes up again. Now, let's look at the quantification of this. So here's the COMS levels that build up. They build up, and the cell triggers competence at this point, and as competence levels at the COMG expression goes up, COMS expression goes down, and as the cell exits competence, it slowly builds up its COMS levels again. So this is a nice negative correlation, and again, you know, a few more data points to show you that this is a general behavior. And this means that our prediction appears to be correct, that the two promoter activities are negatively correlated, which means that this negative repression is probably actually there. However, a stronger prediction is a forward prediction, which is that we're saying that this negative feedback is absolutely necessary for exit, right? If you don't have it, you can't exit your competence state. Now, So we would like to ideally get rid of this. Well, you can't knock this repression out because the binding sites of the promoter is very complicated. There's a lot of overlap, and we don't really understand the commerce promoter regulation that well. Alternatively, you could just get rid of the commerce overall, but that's a paradox, right? Because you need commerce levels to begin with to become competent. So instead, I was thinking, okay, what can I do? And I decided to utilize the beautiful internal dynamics of actually native promoters, such as CalmG. As I've shown you, this CalmG promoter is only expressed during competence, okay? And it correlates nicely with the CalmK promoter. And so what I'm doing here is I've rewired the circuit, if you will, and I'm bypassing the negative repression, okay? Hence the name FBI, feedback bypass. There was many other synonyms that I came up with this part in this, but this was censored for publication, so FBI it was. But so what happens here is that when the cell becomes competent, you have lots of COMK, so you would repress your native production. But here instead, now you're making extra COMS to compensate for this, right? And so the prediction of the model is, when we simulate this circuit, is that now you've generated a bistable system where the competence state is stable. So once you make it here, you get trapped in the stable competence state. Again, we make a movie. So I've made that strain with that rewiring, and I put it into the reporter with the COMG and COMS promoters. And let's look at the movie. So again, the cells are growing, they're expressing COMS, and then we have a cell that becomes competent. And now you notice that the cell does not form this really sort of long elongated fiber. Other cells are dividing. It stays. It stays in this sort of form until it actually like dies. And here's a quantification. So the cell becomes competent. The negative correlation is still there. Okay, and actually the amplitude of the expression is no different than wild type. And you see it's just stuck until it dies. And this perturbation is actually very nice. And here's a few more cells just to show you that it's a general behavior. And this really tells us that this negative feedback, if you bypass it, at least, okay, that you are stuck. So this negative feedback seems to be indeed necessary to exit competence. And what you can do by re-engineering this circuit is you can take this excitable system where you have one stable point, right, which is the vegetative state, and competence is not really a stable fixed point, but it's sort of a regime, right, a region where you go through and come back, and you can rewire that to make a bistable system where now both states are stable. And the interesting thing here is that this is a very specific, okay, and subtle perturbation in the sense that it doesn't affect any of the normal cells. You don't increase your frequency of competence or anything like that, right? It only takes into effect during the competence phase. Now, I mentioned...
When you make it bistable, then you can get out of competence?
Well, if you would then get rid of your additional feedback so that you could repress it, then you would expect that you could, right? Yeah. So at the beginning of the talk, I also mentioned that we were interested in the initiation. Remember, we asked, is it cell autonomous, the decision to become competent, or is it perhaps dependent on the history? Perhaps it's dependent on the microenvironment, and we'd also like to know if there's a memory effect. Now, we measured the probability of competence in our conditions, and it's about 4%, which is sort of consistent with the literature. So if you have a cell division, 4% of the time you can get a competent cell. Now, what we'd like to know is the conditional probability of competence. Why? What does that tell us? Well, the conditional probability of sister cells tells us the following. It tells us whether or not... So first of all, why sister cells? Well, sister cells are as similar as it gets, right? They share the same cytoplasm up until recently. They're in phase with their cell cycle, and they're located in the same microenvironment. They're literally next to each other, right? So by looking at the conditional probability, we can ask the following question. If your sister is competent, what is the probability that you are competent, right? If any of those factors that I just mentioned to you, such as the microenvironment or the history, would be major determinants in the decision to become competent, you would expect that if your sister is competent, that your probability of being competent is much higher than average, right? And when we measured this, it actually turns out that it's the same, which means that the two sister cells appear to be independent in their decision to become competent. This suggests not only sort of that they are, that the decision is cell autonomous, but it's perhaps stochastic. And we can also look at the memory effect. Here you see an actual time trace like the ones before, where you, in one lineage, you have two consecutive competence events. And basically what we have is we have a competent cell, it sort of then exits competence, forms the daughter cells, and we're asking what is the probability of becoming competent after you've been through a competence event. If there's a strong memory effect, again, we would expect that this probability is higher than normal. You can also think about the reverse. If it's a sort of a suppression, then you would expect it to be lower. And when we measured this in the experiments, we saw that the probability was statistically not significantly different from your normal probability of becoming competent, which means that there does not seem to be a significant memory effect, a strong memory effect that sort of pushes you either way. And now, with this very sort of simple analysis, we can answer most of these questions. It doesn't appear to have a memory effect. The history or lineage does not seem to be important either. And the microenvironment also doesn't seem to be very important, which means that it is a cell autonomous decision. Now, I want to go back to this the parameter space, the phase plane that I've shown you. And purposefully, I had left this region unmarked. Actually, it turns out that the model predicts in this regime that you would have oscillatory behavior. Actually, naturally, most excitable systems are near regimes of oscillatory behavior anyway. And this is a prediction that falls out of our model. And let me show you how that looks like with the null clients. So here would be a monostable vegetative. Here's our excursion, our excitable system into competence. And when you increase COM-S levels a little bit more, you will see that the system will start to get trapped in a limit cycle, okay? And we predict that basically the system would oscillate in a regime of competence. Now, how can we access this region of oscillatory behavior? Well, actually, turns out the model says all you need to do is you need to increase your COM-S expression. So what I've done is I've just, very simple, I've taken a plasmid and I've put the exact version here into the plasmid, so you have your native COM-S promoter expressing COM-S just on a plasmid now, which basically pushes your COM-S expression up, and you still have all your regulation there, right? And now we can see whether or not what happens with the cell. And this is actually a little bit recent data, so I have to show it to you as a, hopefully it works. Okay, so doing something. Okay, as a quick time movie. All right, here we see in red is COM-G promoter again. So here's a competent cell. And let's look at it, what it does. So here it becomes competent. Now it exits competence. And interestingly, all the daughter cells that come from the cell go back into competence again. And actually, there's another cell like here that comes out. And then all of its daughter cells go back into the competent state. And when you quantify this, you actually get these nice oscillations in competence. And when you look at a few of them together, you notice the few things that are predicted by the model. One of which is, so here you have a wild-type competence event recorded at the same time under identical conditions. First of all, you see that the amplitude isn't really changed much. But more importantly, you see that this guy goes back down to the basal level, whereas these guys oscillate and don't seem to go all the way down, which is actually something that the model predicts, because now you have one state, which is the competent state, and it's unstable, and you're circling around it, so you're not really ever going all the way back to the vegetative state. And it was just nice to see that not only were we able to have oscillations, but the oscillations behaved in a predictable manner.
What did you do with this oscillating string?
What I did is the following. I just increased COM-S. This corresponds to, actually, I should say, beta S, which is the expression rate in this particular plot. And by just having multiple copies, that's sort of the direction that you're going to. And you were able to make this excitable thing into an oscillatory.
What happens after two periods?
What happens? Oh, well, after, if you notice, this is time in hours. Okay. So, unfortunately, we can't keep these cells there forever, and they're sort of also being pushed towards sporulation and so forth. And there's also phototoxicity effects which take into effect. So simply, and also your pad starts to dry out, like nature kicks in, basically, right? And we can't keep these experiments for much more than, like up, I think this one is like 90 hours or something, so up to 100 hours. After that, you know, we don't get like, unfortunately, like 10 oscillations. But the oscillations are actually pretty nice.
Do you worry about the cells losing the plasmid? Bacteria dividing,
Right, it is a possibility. Right, it is a possibility, right? But we have a very good phenotype. If the cells would lose the plasmid, then you would expect not to see oscillation. So just the sense.
You ever see that?
Yeah, I do see that. But I also see cells that sort of go in once and get stuck. Because if you look at the. If you look at the face space, right, then you see that if you go up too much, right, you will be stuck in competence and you will also die. And obviously when you have a plasmid, there's, you know, copy number fluctuations and so forth. So it's not a perfect...
You see evidence for that.
I see all kinds of data that would be consistent with all these plots here. But the main point is that we also do see oscillations, which is sort of a positive result. All the other ones are negative results, so you can explain them in many ways, right? Right, but that's something that's much more difficult to do, right? I mean, it's difficult to only change the noise but keep the mean the same, right? It's easy, for example, to double everything, where you increase the mean and your noise goes down, right? Your standard deviation over the mean goes down. However, just to play only with the noise experimentally is a more challenging.
But you know that you're not in that state, you're not in the excitable state, and when you increase the com s.
Well, if anything, if we're increasing com s, we're actually reducing the noise, right? Because you're increasing your mean, so your standard deviation of the mean goes down.
So, but presumably, there's a problem with plasmid that can be avoided by putting a reducible.
No, actually that doesn't work, because you do want, well, actually what you want is you want the native regulation there. If I have an inducible promoter, this thing will be on, and this will reproduce basically, in a sense, the Phoebe strain. You want the negative regulation, so you want the native promoter. What you could do is you could put multiple copies of this in the chromosome, right, which is something you can do, but, you know, call me lazy, but I didn't do it.
That'd be a strain less
than
fewer copy number fluctuations,
but does it work? That's right. This was just sort of a prediction. It was just nice to see it. So, and that let me sort of summarize and talk about some of the findings. So, I think I've shown you that the simple circuit here constitutes an excitable system, which is very nice because it naturally explains the two key properties of competence, which is that it's probabilistic and transient in nature. And there's other excitable systems in biology, although this is the first genetic circuit that was identified. But most sort of famously, if you want, is generation of action potentials in neurons. So it's the same exact mechanism. You have sort of a threshold, and once you make it above a threshold, you kick in a certain process, the channels open, etc., and you generate an action potential. And it's interesting to think that there is that both of these are excitable systems, but at completely different time scales, completely different components. And one of the questions that are like is very important to me is why do you have this specific architecture, right? I think there's a lot of important things to be learned by if you could understand this question. Why is the negative feedback loop built this way and so forth? And I think that's something that I'm focusing on right now. Now, but what we do know is that the negative feedback is indeed necessary for the exit, as I've shown you, and that the initiation does appear to be cell autonomous and stochastic. And I've also shown you how by just doing simple rewirings, you can actually amazingly access a whole array of dynamic behaviors. We were able to go from the excitable regime to a bistable regime to an oscillatory regime. And one of the future things that I've been thinking about is the following, right? Here's your bacillus, and I made this drawing just to, you know, make it more fun. But so it stands at this crossroads and it can go into competence. If it goes into competence, it goes around, its trajectory comes back and lost all of its memory of what it did, so it'll decide again. Or it can go into sporulation, it's sort of more of a one-way track. And this is one of the things that I'm working on also right now, which is, here's a very simple diagram that I drew up of the competence circuitry, very briefly. Here's the COMK, here's the disposer A, right? And there's a lot of sort of crosstalk between the two. Usually we like to study signal transduction cascades in isolation because, you know, it's difficult enough. But in the cell, there's a lot of crosstalk and a lot of regulation across these guys. And it would be very interesting to see how this sort of larger circuit gives you this particular output. And in terms of just future goals, I think the key thing that I'm interested in is understanding cellular decision making and differentiation. And I hope that I've shown you that single cell dynamics are not only critical, but I think they're essential to really understand these processes. And what I'd like to do is, and I would like to apply some of these conceptual and experimental tools to other systems and see what we can figure out. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge a few people. Louisa Lieberman was a graduate student that rotated in our lab, and she worked with me on optimizing the movie making conditions. Everybody in the Alowitz lab, David Sprinzak, Victor Eldar, the postdocs, and all the graduate students. It's really, really a great lab to be in. A lot of fun, very stimulating. Jordi, who you see right here, is actually a physicist. He's a professor in Barcelona. And not only is he a friend, but he's a nonlinear dynamics expert, and it's just he's been teaching me a lot about sort of all the intricacies of the system. And of course, Michael, I'm lucky to call him my PI and also my friend. He's just a great guy who also just got recently married. Actually, and Boris was at the wedding, and you know, some funding. And with that, I'll take any questions. Yes, please.
What are the actual propeds and prokay numbers at any given time in such a cell?
So that's a question that's still outstanding. Okay, there's some measurements that people have done, and they are ranging in the thousands for COMK when it's at the maximum expression. For COMS, the numbers are not really known, and I can't tell you from my measurements, right, because I'm looking at the promoter activity, which is not a direct measure of the protein levels.
It seems like the system is pretty easily perturbable by mutation, for example. So what is the selective pressure that maintains it tuned at the level of optimally? What's the...
At the level meaning the frequency or what?
Yeah, the whole thing that maintains, say, the frequency of jumping into the compensating half or the eighths.
That's a great question. Okay, and that's one of the questions that I'm also working on. And I think there's a chance it will fall out of understanding why this architecture. Okay, there's some properties. I mean, this is work in progress. So I don't want to say too much because might all be wrong. there's some properties of the way the circuit is built that might allow you to tune things like frequency. Okay.
So is that frequency?
The frequency in other ones that I'm aware of, in one other one, I should say, is lower. But it's not like, I mean, it's 2% or something, so by half. I don't know what that means. But the problem of frequency tuning is a very interesting one, right? Why? Because how do you tune an event that's longer than a cell cycle, I mean, that longer than your lifespan, right, over the population? It's easy to regulate, for example, gene expression in the cell. How? You make a negative feedback, boom, you can nicely tune the level, right? But if one way you could imagine how you could tune a frequency in a population is if you had cell-cell signaling, right? But the decision to become competent appears to be cell autonomous. So that it's very interesting to think about what properties would allow you to tune the frequency, and this is something that I'm working on.
You can truly imagine, for example, if you there is presumably something in nature that selects competence, and you don't quite know how what it is and how to
right.
control it. But you could artificially select in the fax machine for turning on your favorite competence gene, right? And then presumably by controlling the selection pressure in the fax machine, you could convince your population to become competent more or less often, right?
Perhaps, but I'm sure you also know that that's a difficult thing in the sense that I'm not even sure how well that would work. If indeed it is stochastic, it would mean that it would be very difficult to select to for enrichment, right? So not necessarily, but I think that there's been.
You select for blocking into the competent state. You have to.
Not necessarily. You can select stochastic.
But the growth rate is reduced actually in competent cells.
Assuming that by going competent they pay.
They do pay a penalty, yeah.
Penalty, right? But they're doing it as an insurance policy, just being thrown into the fax machine at that very moment, right? So some fraction of them.
Right. Well, the transient nature of it is also something that's going to.
Yeah,
it's something to think about. Thank you.
I actually have.